Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk, the first show of 2025. You're all very welcome. I hope you had a fantastic new year. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science, and now Blue Sky at News Talk Science. We start off the show, if 2025, as we did 2024 and 10 years, 15 years before that, looking back at the week's science news. There hasn't been an enormous amount of new science, but some interesting stories nonetheless. We're joined in studio by Phil Smith, science broadcaster and all-round TV nice guy, and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Phil.
How you doing? Now you tell me. Am I different somehow? Is it life or is it Memorex?
Has to do with quantum teleportation.
Ooh, teleportation. First thing I think of is Star Trek.
First thing I think of is The Fly.
Yeah.
The best teleportation film or piece of media content ever made. Cronenberg's The Fly with Jeff Goldblum is an app. If you're young or if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend. I'd say the special effects have probably dated a little bit.
Probably, but we haven't. We're still young and fresh, so that's all that matters.
For yourself.
Quantum teleportation, though, this is really quite exciting because quantum teleportation and quantum communications are a field of communications that are very secure. It's one of the main kind of attractiveness about this kind of thing is that you can send packages. If you imagine, like, I was trying to send something to you and I put it in a box and send it, someone can maybe get access to the box. When you do things through quantum communication, that box is unique. No one else can get into it because things are tangled together. So what the researchers from Northwestern University, engineers there, are talking about is that this could provide, quantum teleportation could provide a near instant communication over long distances, but they're starting to look at doing it in existing internet cables. So using the existing, I suppose, infrastructure that's already there. And one of the issues that was happening before was, if you imagine you're trying to get through the Dublin Port Tunnel, you're on a bike and there's a load of trucks going down, you get wobbled and you get thrown all over the place. That's the same kind of thing that happens if you're trying to do this through internet fiber optic cables with a quantum signal. There's a lot of interference. So they found this frequency that allows them to kind of easier get the messages through, which is good. And quantum teleportation, to kind of get into a little bit more technical, it is obviously anything where quantum is more advanced. Do you think of the razors? Do you think of anything else like that?
That's marketing, Phil.
Sorry, apologies.
Don't confuse people. That quantum means nothing. It means absolutely nothing.
Well, that doesn't, but this does. So imagine with quantum teleportation, you're thinking about, like, you're sending instructions of how to build, say, a Lego tower from one place to another place far away. And you do this by entangling particles together. So imagine, like, you have a magic Lego brick. Whatever you do to this one on this end also happens to another magic Lego brick that's entangled down the other end. And you send the instructions kind of across the medium through traditional means, but whatever happens to one happens to the other. So they're entangled together. So it's a really kind of quick, safe, secure thing to do. And one of these experts in quantum communication, Professor Kumar in the electrical and computer engineering in Northwestern, is really kind of saying that they're really only limited, of course, by the speed of light. But this signaling pathway through these existing cables is the real test. They've done it through about a 30-kilometer fiber optic cable that they've done. They've put existing internet signals through it. Next stage, what they want to do is to go over a further distance, but then also now put it out for testing in the real world and see if they can get this proof of concept to work. But it's using existing infrastructure to do something cool, which is the best way to do things. You don't have to build a whole new network to send these things. You just do what's ever there already.
Very good. Our second story, Ruth, has to do with killing in films.
And murderous verbs in films, actually. So this is looking at the use of language that relates to killing, death and murder in films. And it's research from Ohio State University. And what the researchers did was they analysed the subtitles of 160,000 English language films that were produced between 1970 and 2000. And they looked for verbs like kill and murder in a sort of active sense in the script. And what they found was a small but significant increase in the use of those kind of words. So it went up from 0.21% of all the words used to nearly 0.4% of all the words used. So they see this as a trend in film. They found it was across all genres. So it wasn't just in crime films or sort of action films. It was in all genres. They found it for all kinds of characters. So women in general didn't have as much violent dialogue, but they found that for both women and men characters, there was more this trend towards more violent language.
Why were they looking at language?
I mean, I think they're looking at language because researchers, this is something researchers are struggling with as we are exposed to more and more media. And it's been a controversial topic. You know, there's traditional media like TV and films, but also when it comes to games. And I think researchers are really trying to understand what impact this is having on all of us. And I mean, why this is happening, I suppose there's a lot of competition out there for our eyeballs and our ears. And, you know, one of the things that attracts our attention is violence. So there's kind of a tendency, as there's a lot of competition, to put more violence into things because it might make it more compelling viewing. But the reason why the researchers are looking at it is because obviously they're concerned that this might be having an impact, particularly on younger people who are watching maybe more and more violent content over time. And there's been loads of studies that have been done which have found either minimal effects or some small effects or no effects. So we're not really sure yet, is there a definitive causal effect between things like games that have violent content and people maybe going on to be totally desensitized to violence, or indeed worse, that they might become more likely to commit aggressive acts?
Does this add to any evidence? Or does it say anything about what we are experiencing when we watch violence? Is there good research to suggest that if you watch a violent act, you're going to be more violent, you're going to be more traumatized or anything like that?
So the answer is there isn't good research. However, there is some research, particularly looking at children. So children, if they were exposed to more TV violence when they were 8 years old, they were more likely later in life to be arrested and prosecuted for some kind of criminal act as an adult. But again, you know, these studies are relatively small. And I mean, even when you think back to long-term studies, thinking back to a child that was 8, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, they were exposed to something very different to the media we're talking about today. And today, when you think about the graphics and the things that we're seeing in films, it's much more realistic even than graphics that we were looking at 20 years ago, talking about The Fly. So as games and immersive experiences become even more real, I think it's a topic that's worth keeping an eye on. But I probably wouldn't overemphasize this particular study, which was really just looking at words in isolation, out of context.
We have a 13-year-old in the house, and we are really struggling to find films that are, you know, that are not really basic for him, but at the same time don't have a high level of violence. And it's actually incredible what gets through a 12 rating at the moment.
It's very...
And I'm not a... You know, I grew up on horror in the... You know, when I was a teenager, I watched a huge amount of Korean horror and all those early horror films. I don't mind a bit of gore when it makes sense, the film, but it seems to me that there's a huge amount of violence unnecessarily. And it comes from a weird quirk in certification in America, that if you add a couple of swear words, a flash of boobs, or one bit of violence, you'll bump up it to 15. And so a lot of films that wouldn't have ordinarily been 15 are bumped into 15 because that's where the money is. Mm-hmm. Teenagers, who are the people who go to spend money in the films the most, don't want to see a 12s film. And so a lot of films that, like, if you look at Enola Holmes, amazing film, absolutely completely age appropriate, except for one tiny scene at the very end where there's a very violent neck break. You look at a lot of Ryan Reynolds films, almost all of them are perfectly fine, and then he says something really offensive just once. And I think he made reference to it at some point. Actually, a lot of the time we're sort of subjected to this because they want to game the system to make a 12 movie 15. But like, I watched Assassin's Creed, we watched the first 5 minutes, a guy gets his finger cut off, then there's a hanging, and then there's like sticking a needle into someone's brain. And that happens in the first 10 minutes of a 12s film. And it's, you know, some of it's suggested, but it's a lot.
It's a lot. But there's obviously a little bit more of it. I mean, I think that's what this study is showing us.
Our third story, Phil, has to do with happiness.
What a segue. Yeah. I mean, classic. To just maybe pull away at the happiness there, The Fly was actually released in 1986, so that's 38 years ago as opposed to 20. Just for everybody out there, just happy day. This science of happiness, I actually love this study for a number of reasons. Not because it's just about happiness, which is one of my personal passions, but this is about, there's a lot of studies go on, but it's actually the approach they're trying to do to I was going to say coagulate, but bring together studies together into a big study that can make a difference and kind of challenge biases. So, like, the science of happiness has spawned hundreds, thousands of studies about, you know, what lifts spirits exactly and what psychologists...
A lot of it's bollocks.
A lot of it is, yes, true. There's not strong science in it. It's maybe to sell the next best approach to do something else. And this is part of what this is trying to address. So psychologists have drawn up plans for the world's largest happiness experiment to really get rid of all of those types of things and give people the emotional boost and the strategies that they can use to really tackle it. So the goal from Professor Elizabeth Dunn, who's a psychologist at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, is to have the largest, most comprehensive, most diverse experiment on happiness ever concluded. So in the last 6 months, they've recruited over 1,000 scientists for over 70 countries, and they've submitted the proposals to be as part of this. And what they're really doing is really essentially creating a global happiness mega study that they're looking for 30,000 people worldwide to be part of.
Right.
And what they're doing is they're trying to have interventions to see what they're... No intervention is to last longer than 25 minutes. They range from things like physical exercise, yoga, interface channels, social interactions, seeing a loved one, lots of different elements, whatever works. And then she's working with Dr. Bernardis Aslazi, who's from Budapest, and they're trying to bring this all together to see really what matters, but also to say that what works in a lot of the Western world, which is where a lot of these happiness studies are, we have the luxury of maybe some of our science goes towards those types of studies, might not work in Mogadishu or might not work in other parts of the world or for different people. Westerners who are white are considered weird because we're in the minority in the world. So why should we have the monopoly on these types of studies? So this study is bringing together a lot of people together to have something comprehensive that'll make a difference in people's lives, but also for everybody. So this is why I like it and why it makes me happy.
Right. It'd be interesting to see where that goes. And I suppose one such venture might be our final story, Ruth, which is about looking at nature.
I was going to say, there must have been something in the news in Canada about studies on happiness and them getting ready to do it and telling everyone about it, because this is another study that hasn't happened yet, and it's also about happiness. It's from the University of Alberta. And Alberta is a place where, you know, it can get very dark and cold in the winter. It can be down to minus 35 degrees. It can be a hard time for people to cope in the winter. And this is a study to see, through a very small intervention, can we make it a little bit easier to cope in the winter? So there's going to be a group of 100 volunteers who, over the next couple of months, are going to record their feelings as they go about their day, but they're going to make a specific effort to look at natural phenomenon and nature, particularly in kind of urban environments. So they're going to take a moment or two to notice a spider web covered in frost or a beautiful set of icicles or a bird landing on a tree. And they're going to sort of write down how they're feeling, and then they're going to be analysed, their saliva is going to be analysed for cortisol levels to see how stressed or anxious or maybe happy they are. And a control group will do just nothing. They'll just go about their business as normal. And they're going to see whether this taking momentary sort of pauses to value nature can help alleviate your stress and make you feel a little bit better in the dark days of winter.
This study does not make you happy. I think you like this study.
Well, it's not. It hasn't been done yet. So, I mean, it's interesting that neither of these studies have actually been done yet.
It's January. Give us a break.
People are talking about what they're going to do, like the rest of us. I mean, I find it hard to see how the control group is going to work. I mean, they've talked widely about what they're doing in this study now. It's been in the press. So if you know you're in a control group and the idea is not to focus on nature, I feel you might end up doing that anyway. It's a bit like...
But not as much. Like, if you're going to sit and ponder for a second see something beautiful and think about it, you might go, oh yeah, there's a thing. I doubt, you know, if you're going to consciously pay attention to nature, because it's not something I do day to day, but actually... Be interesting to see what comes out.
It will. It builds on other studies which show us that being out in nature, taking an extra few deep breaths, probably does lower our cortisol levels. It does make us feel a little bit less stressed. So, I mean, I think that's what they'll find. But it's interesting to do it in this urban environment. And I suppose it's about interventions that people can actually do, like that other study, Phil. You know, this is kind of a couple of minutes in your day might make you feel better.
Yeah. Although I do feel like I have been given a lot of these interventions over the last while by physiotherapists and other therapists and reading mindfulness books and interviewing guests, and they all say it just takes 2 or 3 minutes, and those 2 or 3 minutes end up like you can spend 3 hours doing these little things just for you. I don't know, I'm a parent, I have my own business, this show, I haven't got time to be happy. That's the way it works.
And on that positive note.
Indeed.
Welcome to 2025, everyone.
Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Phil Smith, thank you very much. You're very welcome back to our very first episode of Future Proof in 2025. Hope it's a good one. And last year was quite a good one for Alzheimer's, where there's a number of breakthroughs, including a drug that can attack those amyloid proteins in the brain that we associate with Alzheimer's, and new blood tests helping to quicker and earlier diagnose the disease. But there was also some very interesting research into a mystery connecting Alzheimer's and cancer. Erin Abner is a professor in the Department of Epidemiology and Environmental Health at the University of Kentucky. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Erin. This is a really interesting subject because it has to do with the link between cancer and Alzheimer's. And these, to me, as a non-medic, seem very different diseases. Can you briefly sort of explain what we know about the mechanism from a very broad level of both? Because what one, you know, it's a neurological disease. It tends to, you know, to be present, as far as we can see, mostly in the brain, you know, inhibiting communication between neurons. And then the other is like a whole host of different diseases that have to do with, you know, the overgrowing or the uncontrolled reproduction of cells.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. You're absolutely right. And that is one of the most intriguing aspects of this question, which is that it appears that people who survive cancer, many types of cancer, are at a lower risk of developing Alzheimer type dementia later in life. One of the aspects of that, as you pointed out, is that cancer broadly is a group of diseases of uncontrolled cell growth. And Alzheimer's and related dementias broadly are a group of diseases that cause uncontrolled cell death, specifically in the brain. And so from a biological perspective, it sort of makes intuitive sense that there could be mechanisms that inherently promote cellular growth, and that those people might at the same time be at higher risk for cancer, but at lower risk for diseases that cause cell death.
So, it appears, although unlikely, that there is some sort of relationship between cancer and Alzheimer's, at least on the face of it. We're looking at a correlation, of course, but it's quite a strong correlation. Isn't that right? Can you give me some numbers as to how likely or less likely you are to get cancer if you have Alzheimer's and vice versa?
Well, I would say that there's different ways of thinking about whether a correlation is strong. And so numerically, I would not say that this relationship is of a large magnitude, we'll say.
Really?
The effect sizes that we see, for example, if we're looking at longitudinal studies and we follow people after they've had a cancer diagnosis to see whether they develop Alzheimer's disease, the magnitude of those things is, you know, something like 50 to 70% probably in terms of a risk reduction that we see overall.
That seems huge to me. Why would that not? I mean, that seems big.
It does seem big, doesn't it? But in epidemiology, there's a saying that it's easy to tell a big thing from nothing, but it's hard to tell a little thing from nothing. Hmm. And so when we're thinking about big things, we're thinking about effects of like 300%, something like that.
Oh, really?
Whereas we get in that like 100 to 200% range, that could well be explained by something that isn't causal.
Okay.
And so when we're looking at numeric estimates like that, to be really confident, we would like to see, you know, these very large effect sizes over and over, but that isn't really what we see. We see these, what we might call moderate effect sizes, which are important, especially across a very large group of people. But the really striking fact for me is that we see this replicated over and over in many different cohorts, many different researchers taking many different approaches, and oftentimes setting out to disprove it, to say, I can explain this, and it's because this research has not been done in this particular way. And then they carry out that study, and they still find that there is an inverse association between cancer and Alzheimer's disease.
Hmm. When did we first recognize this? Is this something we've known for a long time?
Not a terribly long time. And one of the things that we would note is that Alzheimer's research just in general has not existed as a field until about the 1970s, really, even though the disease was discovered, you know, very long time ago. In terms of being able to conduct research, we weren't there until what I would say is fairly recently, you know, the last 50 years. So there is that. So as in terms of the field of Alzheimer's research, we've probably known about it for about half of that time, I would say. But the real focused interest has only occurred in about the last 10 years.
There was a study in 2012 that looked at cancer survivors. And am I reading this right? The cancer survivors had a 33% decreased risk of getting Alzheimer's compared to people without cancer. Is that right?
Right. That's right.
So I mean, that does seem to, it seems to be worth investigating, if nothing else. And I always appreciate a number skeptic on this program. We far too often have... We read in the papers about the opposite, but yes. But when we look at these two diseases from a mechanistic point of view, can we just explore that a little bit and talk about how or why they might have an effect on each other? So when we talk about cancer, we're talking about really lots and lots of different diseases. There's not one thing that we call cancer. It's lots of things, right? But it's typically at its core about uncontrolled reproduction of cells. Would that be fair to say?
I think that's fair to say, yes.
And when we talk about these cancers that have this correlation that we see, is it any type of cancer or is it specific types of cancer?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the limitations in this area of research is that certain types of cancer are much more common than other types of cancer, right? Mm. So the most common types of cancer, your breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer, skin cancer, those are the ones that we typically see studied in this context. And so other cancers, endometrial cancer, pancreatic cancer, for example, we don't have information on. So there's a limitation just in terms of what can you study. And then as you point out, even if we're talking about breast cancer, that's not one disease. That's multiple different types of cellular growth, uncontrolled cellular growth that can happen for different reasons. In terms of a biological explanation, a lot of what we're looking at is genetic and immune pathways that could explain why diseases that appear to share common risk factors, right? We think about risks for cancer and we think about risks for developing dementia. And in terms of lifestyle, environmental, behavioral factors, those are all pretty similar. And so you would think that people who are prone to get one type of disease, chronic disease like that, would be prone to get the same on the other side, but it isn't. So that's where we really get interested. There are certain genes that have been identified as being what we would call upregulated in people who are more likely to get cancer and downregulated in people who are less likely to get cancer.
Okay.
And then the opposite is true. And then for Alzheimer's and those types. But I would also, to complicate this further,
oh, please.
Alzheimer's disease is not one disease either.
So. No, of course it's not. And actually, right. Even, you know, defining Alzheimer's, you know, or diagnosing it. I mean, when we talk about a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, that is recognizing dementia twinned with a recognition of this amyloid plaque buildup that we've heard so much about in the brain. Is that typically how we say this is Alzheimer's?
Well, that depends. So there is at present a bit of a split in the field where, for example, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States has approved these anti-amyloid therapies that you mentioned earlier on the basis of they are affecting the disease process, as you said. They're targeting the amyloid protein. We want to, in the United States, and we're doing studies to say, we need to think about giving these drugs to people before they have overt symptoms of cognitive impairment and dementia, because we truly believe that it's too late in the disease process at that point. Mm. However, the European drug regulators are much more skeptical about using these drugs for that purpose and really consider the disease to be present only when you have symptoms and the biomarkers.
Right.
So it's not clear cut in any regard.
Okay.
What the disease is, it depends on who you ask and what their criteria are.
Right, but what about this then? Is it possible that, you know, when someone gets cancer, we often treat them with chemo? Is it possible that chemo does something to stop Alzheimer's from developing? Because we have had treatments for cancer for some time. That would at least explain why, if you get cancer and you survive, which means you presumably got some sort of treatment, that you would not get Alzheimer's. I mean, that is that plausible?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is one of the main hypotheses that could explain this, right? So either in addition to or instead of this biological hypothesis, could it be that there are treatments that have effects on neuroprotection? And that certainly could be the case. And that's actually where I first sort of encountered this question was a study from 2012 where they had given a skin cancer drug to mice with brain amyloid and saw that amyloid went away. Now, that didn't pan out in the long term as a treatment strategy for Alzheimer's disease, but that line of research continues. What cancer drugs could potentially be repurposed to provide treatment for Alzheimer's disease and related dementias?
Okay, but if we look at the reverse, we haven't really had any treatments for Alzheimer's. So
That's correct. Not
as if, because the weird thing about it is, this relationship seems to be goes both ways, which is really unusual, right?
Yeah, some of the research has said it's not just that we survive cancer and then we're less likely to develop dementia. Some of the research also says once we're diagnosed with dementia, that we're less likely to be diagnosed with cancer in the future relative to people who are similar but not diagnosed with dementia.
Is that because half of all people who get dementia die within 10 years or thereabouts? 70 to 80, isn't it? It's something if you get it in 70 by the time you're 80.
It's something like that. That's another thing that's really hard to actually firmly establish, because if we're talking about people in research studies who are being followed over time, they tend to get diagnosed, you know, as quickly as humanly possible because they're under surveillance. Whereas people out in the community may have a delay, right, of some time in getting diagnosed. And so where you start that survival time makes a difference in how long it is. And so it can be, as you say, in that 10-year range, but it can also be much longer.
You make this sound not easy to solve in a year or two. What about you talked about gene regulation. I mean, are there people who have similar genetic backgrounds who are less likely to get Alzheimer's or more likely to get cancer? Is there anything there potentially?
There is some indication of that in a recent study from the UK Biobank. In fact, not the University of Kentucky, but the United Kingdom Biobank. They have said that there is a particular genetic profile encompassing many, many, many genes, not just a single gene, that appears to be associated with increased cancer risk and at the same time associated with decreased risk of Alzheimer's disease.
Right. So this could theoretically just be a genetic quirk?
It could theoretically be genetic. Both diseases have strong genetic components, but they also have strong gene-environment interaction, right? That there needs to be some type of outer stimulus that interacts with that gene or that genetic profile to cause things to happen later on. So it's probably not as simple as, here's a gene or a group of genes that explains all of it. But I think it's telling that we see this relationship over and over and in different ways, and that there is this suggestion and fairly good evidence that there is this genetic component to it, suggesting again that it isn't just a fluke or bias in the data, but that this may be a real biological relationship.
Tell me about your work and what the next thing you want to look at in this unusual question of the relationship between Alzheimer's and cancer.
So we are currently working on the genetic angle. And so we have I live more in the Alzheimer's space, right, than the cancer space. And so our data sets that we have very detailed measurements on brain health and cognitive performance, but less good quality data on health conditions or medical treatments that they may have.
Yeah.
And so it becomes difficult to take those data sets and say, okay, well, let's look at people with cancer, because literally the variable is just cancer, yes or no, not even what type of cancer necessarily. Right. But what we do have are genetic data. We have GWAS studies that have characterized participants in terms of what are their genetic markers. And so we're currently taking what we call summary statistics from GWAS studies of the UK Biobank for cancer burden. And so we're asking that similar question using Alzheimer's Center data, which is, do people who have a higher genetic burden indicating a type of cancer risk, do they show any differences in terms of their cognitive trajectories over time and what their brain pathology looks like at death?
Do you think that we are looking at a managed disease profile for dementia, that it can be something that just treated like HIV or other diabetes, for example, in the near future, given what we've seen over the last few years in terms of advances on understanding and looking at the disease?
I think it depends on what we mean by the near future.
Yeah.
We're not close to saying we have that breakthrough where we can make people better. Where we are is being able to slow them down in their decline, which is really important. And we're really excited about that, because it can give people more time, right? More time with their families, more time living independently and not institutionalized. So those things are really important, but they don't actually make the disease something that we can just manage and not be devastated by. We're still devastated by it. So we continue to work on this, and we're working on, you know, multifactorial therapies. We know that there are so many things that are going on in the brain when people develop dementia. It's not just that they have Alzheimer's disease. They also have cerebrovascular disease. They also have TDP-43 proteinopathy. They also have Lewy body diseases, all at the same time. And so we know that we're going to have a multi-level approach in order to really make a difference. But ultimately, what we would like to do is prevent people from getting dementia at all.
Mm.
And so if we could find, this biological pathway to say, this is what's going wrong, or this is a way to prevent, you know, this bad outcome, we would really like to move in that direction. But I think that's a ways off. But there's lots of reason for hope. We're moving really fast. And I think, you know, 10, 20 years down the line, we'll really be in good shape.
Okay. Professor Aaron Abner from the Department of Epidemiology, University of Kentucky. Thank you so much for your time. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Jonathan. Happy New Year.
I kind of feel every year in this program that we're tantalizingly close to discovering some really weird things about how diseases that ravage the human race work, how our bodies work. I often don't get to hear the outcomes of those, because most of the time they don't pan out, right? Like some great ideas, and this could be this, and then a lot of the time it takes 15, 20 years for it to come to a fruition anyway. So some of the technology stuff has certainly come to pan. But even if we look at graphene, right? Graphene as a technology is something we reported on way back when it was discovered on the program. And I feel like, yes, it's obviously used in manufacturing, and 2D materials are doing lots of amazing things in research, but like, it's not like our lives have been fundamentally changed by graphene just yet. So it does take a long time for these things to happen. But like, this is a really weird relationship and very interesting to see. Maybe in 20 years we'll look back and go, oh, that's why. But right now we're not quite sure.
Yeah, you and I are sort of deprived somewhat from the surprise of it, because it's so gradual. And that we're kind of, you'll hear a little, it's like chipping away at the stone. You're like, oh yeah, I heard this bit about Alzheimer's and this bit. And, you know, there's so much progress being made on Alzheimer's that maybe, hopefully, in like 5-10 years, they'll be able to go, you know, Alzheimer's will be very treatable in the way that HIV is maybe now. And it'll be, for some people, that'll be like, wow, this is absolutely amazing. I didn't see this coming at all. But for us, it'll be like, yeah, that was kind of coming.
Yeah, yeah. And they say that, that's what they say about AI, that if you look at what, you know, people talking about, you know, artificial super intelligence, right? Sam Altman and the usual people. what a lot of the people are saying is that it has been plotted. It's been plotted since 10 years ago that we were going to end up here. And so don't be surprised when it will happen. And so it looks like it will happen pretty flippin' soon. Like looking at the most recent data, they're outperforming humans in so many different categories. And obviously there are some categories when they don't, but not just outperforming humans, but the best of humans. And I think that's, when you talk about superintelligence, if you're outperforming the best of all humans, and actually I saw one graph recently and someone quipped on it saying, we're at a stage now where we are celebrating that the sum of all human knowledge is still better than what one particular model can do. Like, so all scientists in a particular field are better than this one model.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask you. The graph goes on is what I want. Like, okay, so plan 10 years up to now. What's the next 10 years? Because we did that piece a few years ago on superintelligence, and it was like, the long and the short of it was, yeah, if this happens, we'll all live forever, or the machine will turn us all into paperclips.
Yeah.
And we'll just have to see which way it goes. Do they know that yet?
Yeah.
Maybe you should ask them.
But that's one of the great event horizons, right? I mean, running out of oil, for example, running out of water. These are event horizons where it's very very difficult to know what the future looks like. I think, superintelligence is a much more short-term and realistic one. Like, what will happen when we have artificial superintelligence in our, in our pockets? And will it stay in our pockets?
It'll have us in its pocket.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how we segued into that, but there we go. Happy New Year. How was your everything?
It was lovely. It was overindulgent, as I believe it should be. And all the family was together. And yeah, it was very good. I never want to see any alcohol ever again.
I feel like a lot of the time I felt like a pressure in my stomach area. And I just feel like, even though it happened consistently, like every day for like 2 weeks, I didn't stop eating.
No.
It's kind of like, I knew I didn't want to feel the way up, but I kept on eating. It's kind of strange. I feel like this is a new year, a year of new beginnings. A year of adventures. I'm excited about the new year. For the first time in 365 days. I'm always excited about New Year's. I'm always excited. I'm always like, this is the year I'm going to do something new and better, and I'm going to recreate myself, and I'm going to...
No, this is the year, Jonathan. You're right.
This is the year.
Yeah. All you needed was someone to cheerlead along with you.
If you're feeling like this is the year that I come out of the chrysalis, let me know. You can email us. science@newstalk.com is your email address for your emails. And just one of the comments, one or two comments from the past couple of weeks, because we were kind of off and stuff. But we did this amazing piece a few weeks back on thanatology, which is the study of death. And it was actually with Susanna Monzo, who was looking at how other animals perceive the death of animals. So how animals see the death of other animals. It was really interesting. We got this amazing text from one of our listeners. They said years ago, because we were talking about playing possum, where these amazing animals that just play dead when it suits them as a survival instinct. And this person texted in saying, years ago, I heard a story of a fox who got into a chicken coop. The farmer came out and saw the fox lying dead with the chickens around. The farmer went to get a rake to throw the fox's body out. And on his way back with the rake, the fox pissed it by him. Good program.
Smart fox.
Very good.
Cunning as a fox.
A wily fox. Yeah. There's a few videos on like TikTok about squirrels doing that. Isn't there one of a squirrel like does a very dramatic death and just lies down? Have you seen it?
I've seen a few of those. There's one as well. I don't know what it is with goats. It's like, have you ever seen a thing where goats get confused for some reason? It's often when they're trying to get over a step. And all their limbs, they just turn into like a wooden horse. They just freeze and they just fall over very slowly in a very comic manner with their legs completely straight. Have you ever seen those videos? They do it all. It's really weird. I've seen loads of them.
You've seen the one of the chicken and the line in the sand?
No.
Have you not?
No.
Oh, man. If you draw a line in the sand in front of a chicken, put a chicken's head down in the sand. Just push gently down the sand, right?
Yeah.
And then you draw a line in front of it from its nose. It won't move. It'll stick there. That chicken will not move. And when you rub away the line, the chicken goes mental. And loads of videos of this on the internet.
I love these things.
We need to do a feature on what the hell's going on with animals and are animals broken. Because like that feels like a real like a, you know, like you remember in the old 80s games, you'd have like you press five or six different buttons, like X, Y, A, B, or left bumper, right bumper,
and
you get a cheat code
or a glitch.
And then something would happen. It feels like you can do that with a few animals.
That's amazing, because we should do something on this, because there's two others that I can think of immediately offhand. One is the lobster. If you like have a lobster and there's a certain part of its body, if you just rub like gently on one part of it, it's like its head or something, it just goes catatonic and it can't move. And
oh, really?
It's completely like immobile. And I don't know how you get it back. I think maybe put water over it or something, but it just stops dead. And then the other one I've seen, these are all things that we've just seen. Maybe they're all bullshit, but
one's definitely not bullshit.
The other one is toddlers. Toddlers don't like their feet to touch grass. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Unbelievable. So people they lower their toddler towards like the grass, and the toddler will move its feet up to try and stay away for as long as possible so it's not on the grass. No idea why.
We've got to do animal hacks, cheat codes for animals. Yeah. That'd be a good feature. We're also asking for your stories of science teachers. And Owen says, hi guys, catching up with the podcast. I'd heard you talk about science teachers. I can 100% say that my science teacher in first year of secondary school changed how I look at everything. It wasn't necessarily that there was a particular experiment or anything. It was more his style of teaching and energy for the subject. This is 1997. From my best memory, science wasn't really being done to any major level in primary school then. Things are different now. So when I started secondary school, studying science seemed like the coolest thing ever. I still remember learning specific things in first and second year with him. And from that point on, I was always going into the world of science. That enthusiasm for which he had for science inspired me to study science, carry out research, and ultimately now talk about science, be that through SciComm or through my own teaching. Crazy how one person really can change how you view the world. All the best, Owen. Now, that is the sort of story that we are looking for from you. We want to gather a few of these stories. We want to do something cool with them, right? So we want to hear from you. If you had a science teacher in school that inspired you and you did things differently in your career or in your research or whatever, you just actually changed what you were doing because you were inspired by the science teacher, we want to hear those stories. So if you know someone like that, or that's you, email us, science@newstalk.com. We would really appreciate that. That's it, I think, for this week's pod. Aidan McKelvey. You're taking a hiatus. We hope to have you back soon.
I am, yeah.
Moving on to produce...
Moncrief. Yes, I'll be on Moncrief for the next while.
Big shoes to fill.
Yeah, just robbing some of the stories from this show and throwing it on a different show.
Yeah, really. That's what they do anyway on that show. That's what they do anyway. It is a great show. So I'm sure it'll only get better. Thanks for all of your service. And we hope to have you back when the maternity leave is over. That's it for this episode. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey. Hugo de Silva on sound. We'll be back with more on Tuesday in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.